This podcast is part of the MyPodcast.com network. Go online right now and get your very own 100% free podcast, MyPodcast.com.
Hi, I'm Scott Watson, and this is What Music Means to Me. Copyright, or the right to copy, should concern anyone who listens to, performs, or creates music of any kind, especially in this digital age. In this episode of What Music Means to Me, the first of a two-part series with author James Frankel, we discuss Frankel's new book, The Teacher's Guide to Music, Media, and Copyright Law. Frankel is the director of Soundtree, the educational division of Korg USA. But for years he served as a music teacher at Franklin Avenue Middle School in Franklin Lakes, New Jersey. He holds a doctorate in music education from Columbia University's Teachers College, where he currently teaches courses on using technology in music education. Frankel's new book, published by Hal Leonard, promises to be the authoritative resource on copyright for educators, especially music teachers. Jim, it's so great to have you as my guest on What Music Means to Me.
Thanks, Scott. It's great to be here, and I'm a big fan of your show and all the work that you do, so it's my pleasure.
Well, thank you. Not to be disparaging or anything, but I guess when I first picked up your book, I was expecting a much more clinical report on what I assumed was a really arcane area of law, and instead I was really pleasantly surprised with some of the personal nature of your writing and the way that it conveyed copyright law. So let me just say right off the bat, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
One example of an area that I didn't expect to read in the book, but was thoroughly interested in, was the whole thing on the history of copyright law. And I was just wondering, aside from just offering some background, what were you hoping the reader would take from knowing that history?
I think that to me, the history was fascinating and always has been, and helped me to understand what the laws were actually about in the first place. I think that a lot of teachers, myself included, don't really understand what the word copyright in itself means. And surveying the history, I thought it was important for teachers to see how we got from the beginning to today's copyright law, and how the origins of copyright law, dating back to the Stationers Guild in England, is really similar to what many critics of copyright law believe is happening today with the perpetual copyright protection, which is really something that they were they enjoyed back there in merry old England. So I thought it was important to include it, and I tried to the chapter title of number two. It's a brief but interesting. I put in. So that people wouldn't just skip over it.
I just assumed copyright was always about protecting people like publishers, and your background kind of colored my awareness of how part of the law was to encourage the flourishing of creativity and things like that too.
And I think it's also interesting to see all of the famous people, John Philip Sousa, Victor Herbert, Mark Twain, among others, who were huge proponents of copyright law protection. And I think when music teachers specifically hear what John Philip Sousa and Victor Herbert and their fight for their protection of their intellectual property, makes it a little bit more easy to understand.
Right, and it's not just celebrities in the 21st century at the Oscars that have political views, right?
No, absolutely. Absolutely, that's well said.
Yeah. Now, I've seen some of the sessions you deliver all over the country on the topic of copyright awareness, but it wasn't until I read the book that I learned how personal a subject copyright infringement was to you. I thought it'd be interesting if you share some of the life events that maybe have given you a special interest in copyright law.
The book starts off with me telling an innocent tale of a crime that I committed when I was 4 years old, stealing candy from a supermarket.
Yes.
And my mother, instead of kind of just brushing it under the rug and scolding me, bringing me to the manager instead. And I guess in the early 1970s. That was the thing to do, and making me confess my crime, and the gentleman made me promise never to steal anything again. And the reason I include that story is that being raised, my father was a New York City police officer, I was always afraid of consequences of, okay, if I steal, then I will get in trouble and, you know, I might go to jail. Those consequences really made me a law-abiding citizen, and it really, to this day, I still think about those things. But to frame it in a copyright thing, I thought I was, you know, I never stole until one day a computer administrator overheard me telling my 8th grade general music students how to swipe HTML code from another website if they liked something they saw on a website. It was a common thing to do among coders, is just to copy each other's HTML code.
To grab the source code.
Absolutely, and then put it in your own. And I thought I was teaching the kids a wonderful skill, but the computer administrator, came barging out of her office, yelling at me, asking me how on earth I could teach kids, you know, to steal. And it actually hit me very personally. I was totally incensed that she did that, and of course didn't want to admit that she might have been right. Mm-hmm. And in the introduction to the book, I say how that's where it all started for me, is I tried to prove her wrong by buying a book on copyright law, and then quickly realizing that almost everything I did as a music teacher on a daily basis was an infringement of copyright law. Photocopying music, photocopying worksheets out of theory books, making CDs and recordings of my performances and charging people for them without paying royalties. Everything that music teachers do that they think is a really good pedagogical tool, and many of them in fact are, I realized quickly I was just breaking the law left and right. So that's really how I got interested in copyright law, and that was about, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Well, as your book makes clear, there's two areas of copyright law that are, I think, very widely misunderstood, and those are fair use and public domain, especially in music education. And I was wondering if you'd mind giving a plain language description of fair use and of public domain, and maybe an example of how these have been misused or misunderstood by music teachers.
I'll start with the easy one, Scott, and that's public domain. When you talk about giving an easy-to-understand plain language, public domain's pretty obvious. Public domain literally means music that has fallen, or any material that has fallen out of copyright. And the date for those, for materials falling into that public domain actually vary. The current law that we live under protects a work for 70 years beyond the life of the author.
Okay.
However, there's some kind of complicated math when it comes to works that were created before the Copyright Act of 1976, and so that date actually varies of when music will fall into the public domain. There's a commonly known date of 1923, and that's because of math and the 1976 law. But actually, there's a lot of music that is, and works of literature and art that are already in the public domain that came after that. The easiest way to find out is there's a great little website, although it's not comprehensive. It certainly gives a quick and easy guide for music that's in the public domain, and that's at pdinfo.com. PD as in public domain info.com.
Right.
And that's a great source, but it's not complete. The only way to find definitively whether a work is in the public domain or not is to go to the U.S. Copyright Office website, which is at copyright.gov, and you can do a search. For music teachers, what this means is that if there's a work of music that is in the public domain, you can pretty much do whatever you'd like with it. However, this gets a little confusing, if the piece of music, let's say, take for example, a piano sonata by Mozart, while the actual work may be in the public domain because Mozart died many years ago, and certainly long before 1923, the actual publication, so if Carl Fischer or Schirmer puts out an edition of the Mozart work,
right,
the actual paper publication that Schirmer produces is protected by copyright law, even though the work, the notes on the page, are in the public domain.
Mm-hmm.
It gets really confusing, but public domain simply means that the music itself, you are allowed to use it for any purpose as long as the source of that music that you found is not copyright protected. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so the plain language definition is really obvious, but the misunderstanding might be that if a certain edition is a certain edition may still be protected. And
absolutely.
And they would see a copyright notice probably, right?
Sure. Otherwise, for example, if you were from Carl Fischer and you put out a collection of the works of Bach, that does not give anyone the right to photocopy those. Otherwise, no one would bother publishing the music of Bach anymore if there wasn't that protection.
Right.
So that's public domain, and fair use is really, unfortunately, for some music teachers or for teachers in general, they use the shield of fair use to kind of defend anything that they do in the classroom, any use of copyrighted materials. Many teachers believe just because they're a teacher and using them makes it a fair use, and that is completely wrong.
The umbrella is not that big, in other words.
No, it's not. One of the chapters in the book is just all on fair use, and it's a lengthy chapter to explain not too much writing in the law. What fair use, basically, the four factors of fair use, which are the purpose and the character of the use of the work, that's the first one. It means, like, are you using this for an educational purpose? And that's always an answer, yes, I'm using it for an educational purpose. If you were a business, for example, using materials that were copyright protected, often that wouldn't be the case. It wouldn't be a fair use.
I took good notes on your book, and those four factors, maybe I could just give you each one of them, and you could do exactly what you're doing, elaborate.
Sure. Okay, so that'd be great. Thank you.
You've just done it for the first one. And then the second one, as I understand it, is the nature of the copyrighted work.
Right. The nature of the copyrighted work really means what was it's a little harder to interpret than factor one, but it's how was it originally presented to the public? So, I mean, for most teachers, what that means in a nutshell is the work that you're using in your classroom, was it published? If it is, okay, you can go on. If it's not, if it was an unpublished work, you may be invading on that author's privacy.
Hmm. Okay, how about number three, which I took down as the amount or the substantiality of the portion relative to the whole?
Right. Now, this is really, most people think of the less than 30 seconds or 10% rule.
Okay.
That is not written in the law anywhere. It doesn't say officially that that's the, if it's less than 30 seconds, then it's okay, or less than 10%. That was actually a criteria that was drawn up by a organization called CONFU, which was the convention or the conference on fair use, which happened around the time when fair use was written into the copyright law in 1976, and that 10% 30 seconds is really up to a judge hearing the case whether or not the amount of material used is substantial. But what it really means for teachers is you can't use a performable unit. Like if you had an opera and you were going to say, well, I'm going to photocopy an aria out of that, you wouldn't be able to, and quite rightly, in my opinion. So that 10% 30 seconds, that's where, you know, the aria may be only 2 minutes long and the opera 4 hours. But if that aria is a performable unit, do not pass go, do not collect $200.
Right. And then the fourth area is the effect of the use on the market or the value of the work.
Right. Now, this is really what it comes down to, what all this comes down to is money. And what teachers should ask themselves is, look, am I taking money out of somebody's hands by using it this way? So, for example, if you are going to great example of this in fair use would be, you are doing a musical at your middle school, it's like one of those Broadway Junior editions, and it comes with an accompaniment CD. And so, what you decide to do is, hey, I'd like to make a copy of this accompaniment CD to give to every member of the cast, and oh, it'll be such a great way to get them to learn their music, and what a great pedagogical tool, so I'm going to make copies, and it's a fair use because, it's educational. Well, here the fourth factor of, what is the effect of that use? You're totally taking money out of that publisher's hands by eliminating the possible sale of that accompaniment CD, which is most likely for sale. You could probably buy that accompaniment CD for every member of the cast.
Right.
But so by just deciding, I'm going to make copies of it, you're completely taking money out of the publisher's hands and the copyright owner's hands.
Right.
And so that's what the fourth factor is.
And they would, the publisher would either make it for sale or allow you to license the copies, and you go ahead and copy it on your own. You're obviously circumventing something there.
And Scott, I think it's important to note for all educators, there's always a legal way. It's almost always there. It may not be the most affordable option, but there's always a way to do it legally. And what teachers, when it comes to this whole fair use thing, you have to be informed. You have to understand fair use, because it's not like if let's say, for example, you were to do that and make 75 copies of this accompaniment CD for your cast, you can't just claim stupidity when the copyright police come knocking. You have to be able to say, well, I thought it was a fair use. I looked through the fair use guidelines, and this is what I, you know, considered fair. I think I put it at the beginning of the chapter. If they're going to read one chapter in the book, it's chapter 4, which is understanding fair use.
Yeah. Because
it is a great and sturdy umbrella if you're doing it the right way, and it's got a lot of holes in it if you just have a foggy understanding of it.
No, I think you explained it in the book and now very well. But speaking of specific examples, your book is chock full of all sorts of scenarios and vignettes, and you portray everyday situations that educators should be mindful of. For instance, in Chapter 5, you call it copyright or copy wrong, and there's 50 questions that an educator might have about copyright materials. And then again in Chapter 8, copyright in the classroom, there's 20 different lesson plans that you examine how this could be done legally and what some of the missteps are. And
right.
Here's how you take it. Do you mind if we talk about just a few? I don't want to go through all 70 of those scenarios.
No, it's fine. I'm happy to go through some of the
things. Yeah, I picked up four that I think everybody's going to relate to. Like, for starters, many music directors photocopy music. Choral directors photocopy scores. Band directors photocopy instrumental parts. Maybe to save a few bucks, or that they don't want the original parts to get lost or damaged by students, or maybe the director wants the students to be able to, mark up the copied parts with a pencil,
right.
with some helpful notations. But none of this is legal, right?
Correct. Absolutely none of it. And I will just preface all of this by saying I am thoroughly guilty of doing that,
mm-hmm.
And I think almost every music teacher in America at one time or another has done it. However, it is not, there is very clearly on almost every single piece of music at the bottom, it says photocopying is illegal. And what most music teachers do is there's a loophole that they think applies to them, which is in case of an emergency, I can make an emergency copy. And so a lot of teachers that I know would rationalize it by saying, look, I've bought the part. You should be thrilled that I bought this arrangement from you.
Right.
I am now going to photocopy to my heart's content. I'm never going to give out the originals. And I have to say I've done that. And I think many music teachers do that. And every music teacher's argument is, well, then give me more than 4 alto saxophone parts.
Exactly, yeah.
Right. And I totally agree with that. And I personally would have liked to have had 18 saxophone parts, which teaching middle school band, that's what I like I always
right.
had. However, the law very clearly states that you need to purchase a part for everybody who's performing it. In fact, on the stage, at a performance, according to the law, students must be playing from an original.
Mm.
And that emergency clause that everyone likes to use, it actually says that you can do that. You can make a photocopy of a part in an emergency. And then the part that people don't read beyond, it says, provided that a replacement part is purchased in due course. And I'll tell you, and this will let down my cards to show you that I actually have done this, I would buy the extra parts from J.W. Pepper, and the funny thing is they would send me a photocopied part with a red stamp that
right.
says, like, legal photocopy
yep.
or whatever. And I just laughed, but that's what they do. You talk to composers like yourself, and I have a very good friend of mine who's a composer, and most of them are just thrilled that educators are buying their arrangements,
yep.
period, and they don't really, they kind of turn a blind eye for what happens afterwards. But the law is very clear, and it says that you can't photocopy.
Well, since you raised the issue, I get a royalty check a couple times a year, and a piece that's very popular the first year all of a sudden drops off the map the second year. You realize what's happening.
Oh, absolutely.
And,
you know, that is that. And to me, if music educators don't support composers like yourself and others, then the music won't keep coming. Everyone knows, it's very difficult to be a full-time composer. You know, I always say support the musicians you admire by purchasing their music.
One of the most commonplace violations of copyright music I see each year involves high school marching bands performing their own custom arrangements of protected music. And I have to say, in another life, I used to do a lot of marching band arranging and have fallen into this trap, unknowingly actually at the time. But now when I look back, I can't believe what I did, and also what many people continue to do every year. So there's some dangers, right? If you're arranging Wicked for your halftime show, music from a Broadway musical that's on Broadway currently, right, would not be...
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there are some composers... I won't name them here, but you can do your research. There are some composers who will never give you ever permission to arrange their works for a marching band. And there's a very famous case, which I won't get into now, of a well-known drum and bugle corps organization that was sued for doing these exact types of things, putting out arrangements of very well-known composers of film and Broadway and putting them on the field without paying any kind of royalty, without asking for permission at all. And, you know, a lot of music teachers would say, oh, what's the big deal? We're not taking money out of your pockets. We're just doing this to have a good halftime show and a competition. We're not making a cent off of it. And that's really not the point. One of the protections of copyright is to protect the author from having derivative works made of theirs. So let's say, for example, Scott, you write a melody, and then that somebody takes it without any permission and changes it and makes it totally different. Mm-hmm. You at least deserve the courtesy or to be asked for permission to do so. And knowing you, Scott, you'd probably say yes.
Well,
but a lot of marching band arrangers out there, the last thing on their mind is asking permission to do so. They just do it because they're getting a nice little check, and it's cool that they're doing some arranging work, and the arrangements often sound really good. But without permission to do so, it is complete infringement of copyright law. And, you know, what I would say to band directors out there is you are not absolved of guilt. It's not the arranger that's on the hook. It's also the people who bought the arrangement. If a composer got wind that their piece was being used without their permission, then everyone's on the hook.
So that was going to be my next question, is who's liable? So you're saying the arranger,
yeah,
the band director?
Everyone would be named in the lawsuit. There's no question. Even though the violator is the original arranger, it's a work for hire. So the school district that paid the arranger is completely as liable as the arranger. Because they paid for it. And so as a work for hire, they now bought a liability.
I think this is one of the coolest things about being aware of copyright law is some of the neat things that happen. I did an arrangement for my band of a medley of the Broadway musical Titanic, three tunes from Maury Yeston's Titanic, and their publisher gave us those rights for free and gave me Maury Yeston's email address so that we could tell him how much we enjoyed performing his music, and my students thought it was cool. You know, so there's some neat connections and networking that can actually happen if you take a little bit of time to pursue those things.
Well, those are fantastic stories, and I think that rather than teachers getting incensed and thinking that they're being victimized by the law, I do think that, you know, if you, and that's one of the major intents of my book is that, look, if you do it the right way, if you ask for permission, you're going to get the warm fuzzies. First of all, you may, like you're saying, you may actually talk to the composer. They may say, hey, I'd love to come and hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Composers are not, you know, it's not like they're all stodgy old white men that are, you know, writing, symphonies. The composers are people. And asking them, hey, can we, I'd love to do this. I love your work. Can I have permission? I think that teachers would be surprised how often they would be granted permission to do so.
Right.
Because composers are really fun people.
Yeah, there's another story, too, just thought of. My high school music production class does a holiday CD, and I usually have them do public domain tunes, but the chorus at our school was singing this really neat arrangement by a gifted composer and arranger. His name is Jackson Berkey. And so the kids in my class wanted to record this for the CD, so I said, well, we got to get, you know, mechanical for it. So we ended up contacting his publisher. It turns out he's self-published, and all he wanted was two copies of the CD to allow us to waive the mechanical right for it. And plus, in talking to him, we had a couple phone conversations. It turns out he's the keyboard player for Mannheim Steamroller.
So, oh, my goodness.
So it's like, wow, you know, I love your work there, too. You know,
no, that's great. I'm glad that you got that story on this interview, because those are the types of things that will make teachers not so mad about the process, but actually it could be a very good thing.
In part two of my conversation with James Frankel, we explore several more everyday copyright scenarios for music educators and take a look at some of the ramifications of copyright in the digital age. I hope you'll join us. I know you have a lot to do, so thank you for taking the time to learn what music means to me. I hope music is and stays a part of your life. Until next time, stay in tune.